This is the Cambridge Assessment International Education, Cambridge IGCSE, March 2021 examination in English as a Second Language. Paper 4. Listening. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number, and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the exam. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you are doing the exam. Teacher, please give out the question papers, and when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you are all ready, here is the exam. Exercise 1. You will hear 4 short recordings. Answer each question on the line provided. Write no more than 3 words or a number for each answer. You will hear each recording twice. Question 1. A. What time are the friends meeting before the birthday party? B. What present did the boy buy?
I've no idea how I'm going to get to Kate's birthday party tonight, do you?
My dad offered to give me a lift. Shall we pick you up?
That'd be great, thanks. I'll be ready at 6.
The party starts at 7 and it's not far, so if we get you at 6:30, that'll give us plenty of time. Anyway, what did you get Kate for her birthday?
I thought about jewellery, but then went for a purse. What do you reckon?
Well, I don't think she's got one, so that's a good idea. I got her a scarf.
I've no idea how I'm going to get to Kate's birthday party tonight, do you?
My dad offered to give me a lift. Shall we pick you up?
That'd be great, thanks. I'll be ready at 6.
The party starts at 7 and it's not far, so if we get you at 6:30, that'll give us plenty of time. Anyway, what did you get Kate for her birthday?
I thought about jewellery, but then went for a purse. What do you reckon?
Well, I don't think she's got one, so that's a good idea. I got her a scarf.
Question 2. A. What was the most popular activity during the charity event? B. Where can students now see pictures from the event?
I'd like to say a few words about the recent event at school to raise money for a local charity. Those of you who attended will know that we had a variety of activities, from sports competitions to cake sales. But it was the face painting that attracted most interest. It raised £178. A big thank you to everyone who worked hard to make it such a great success. We'll be including all the photos in the next edition of the school magazine, but we've already put a few of the best ones up in reception if you can't wait until then. I'd like to say a few words about the recent event at school to raise money for a local charity. Those of you who attended will know that we had a variety of activities, from sports competitions to cake sales. But it was the face painting that attracted most interest. It raised £178. A big thank you to everyone who worked hard to make it such a great success. We'll be including all the photos in the next edition of the school magazine. But we've already put a few of the best ones up in reception if you can't wait until then.
Question 3. A. What is currently on display at the gallery? B. Where will the two friends meet?
Do you fancy going to the gallery this weekend?
What's on? Is it the wildlife photographs by the guy who grew up in Russia?
That's finished already, Though I've got to say, his snow fox pictures were stunning. It's the one about old coins I was thinking about.
Okay, I've got some free time on Saturday.
Sure. I'll be at the swimming pool until 3, so we could meet at the cafe there?
I'll be studying at the library, so why don't you come and find me there when you're ready? It's just round the corner from the gallery, isn't it?
Okay, see you then. Do you fancy going to the gallery this weekend?
What's on? Is it the wildlife photographs by the guy who grew up in Russia?
That's finished already. Though I've got to say, his snow fox pictures were stunning. It's the one about old coins I was thinking about.
Okay, I've got some free time on Saturday.
Sure. I'll be at the swimming pool until 3, so we could meet at the cafe there?
I'll be studying at the library, so why don't you come and find me there when you're ready? It's just round the corner from the gallery, isn't it?
Okay, see you then.
Question 4. A. What did Robert Bazot build out of plastic bottles? B. How many plastic bottles did he use?
Now for an unusual piece of news. Robert Bazot is a designer who's been working with plastic bottles. Although plastic bottles have previously been used in the construction of houses and even roads, Bazot was the first person to create a castle using these objects. He built it on an island in Panama to show how plastic waste can be reused. Did you know you need on average 16,000 bottles to build a 100 square meter house? That's a lot. Though he needed 40,000 to complete his project. Amazingly, they were all collected from the island. The island attracts over 100,000 tourists each year, who leave behind over 1 million plastic bottles. Now for an unusual piece of news. Robert Bazot is a designer who's been working with plastic bottles. Although plastic bottles have previously been used in the construction of houses and even roads, Bazot was the first person to create a castle using these objects. He built it on an island in Panama to show how plastic waste can be reused. Did you know you need on average 16,000 bottles to build a 100 square meter house? That's a lot. Though he needed 40,000 to complete his project. Amazingly, they were all collected from the island. The island attracts over 100,000 tourists each year, who leave behind over 1 million plastic bottles.
That is the end of the 4 short recordings. In a moment, you will hear exercise 2. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 2. You will hear a student, Hannah, giving a talk about taking a gap year, which is a year off between school and university. Listen to the talk and complete the details below. Write 1 or 2 words or a number in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
Hello, my name's Hannah. I'm in my first year at university. But before my course started, I decided to take a year off, what's known as a gap year. In some countries, this is quite common. Lots of students take the opportunity to work or travel during this time. Some of you might even be interested in taking a gap year, so I hope you'll find this talk useful. I took a while to decide whether I wanted to take a gap year. I liked the idea, but also found it a bit scary. My teacher gave me some information about it, and then I had lots of conversations with my parents and friends. It was actually something that my neighbour said that convinced me I should give it a go. I always knew that I didn't want to take the risk of organising the gap year myself, so I looked into various companies who can do it for you. It can be quite hard deciding which company to choose, so it's a good idea to do some research to begin with. It's worth checking what their fees are, which can be very high. I'd say their reputation should be your main concern, though. I looked into what I could do during my gap year. I knew I wanted to travel, and I decided to go to the island of Bali, which is in Indonesia. I really wanted to volunteer at a national park, but I was too late to apply, so I went for a job at a diving centre. This turned out to be better than other possibilities that I considered, like helping in a school. Although a gap year means taking 12 months out of education, you don't necessarily have to spend the whole time in a different country. I'd give yourself 4 months to save up enough money beforehand, then 6 months abroad, doing whatever it is you've chosen to do, which leaves you 2 months when you return to get ready for university. When it comes to packing, try not to take too much stuff with you. Obviously, you need your travel documents and essentials, like your phone and charger. Then think about any medicine you might need. You'd be surprised at how many people leave that at home. You should also plan how you're going to stay in touch with family and friends. When I first arrived, I wrote a long letter every week to my family about my experiences. I found out they took at least 4 weeks to arrive, though. Then, when I met someone else who had a blog, I realised that that's the thing to do. Of course, an occasional phone call is nice, but in reality, the time difference can make that tricky. There are lots of things you'll need to adapt to when you're in another country. The language, of course, but luckily, so many people speak English. I knew I'd struggle with the spicy food, though most of my friends there loved it. I hadn't realised the effect the climate would have on us, though. I really enjoyed my time away, and I'd definitely recommend taking a gap year. It's a good way to make friends, and you might even develop skills that you can use in the future. You'll gain confidence too, and I think that's the most valuable part of the experience. Now, are there any questions?
Now you will hear the talk again.
Hello, my name's Hannah. I'm in my first year at university, but before my course started, I decided to take a year off, what's known as a gap year. In some countries, this is quite common. Lots of students take the opportunity to work or travel during this time. Some of you might even be interested in taking a gap year, so I hope you'll find this talk useful. I took a while to decide whether I wanted to take a gap year. I liked the idea, but also found it a bit scary. My teacher gave me some information about it, and then I had lots of conversations with my parents and friends. It was actually something that my neighbour said that convinced me I should give it a go. I always knew that I didn't want to take the risk of organising the gap year myself, so I looked into various companies who can do it for you. It can be quite hard deciding which company to choose, so it's a good idea to do some research to begin with. It's worth checking what their fees are, which can be very high. I'd say their reputation should be your main concern, though. I looked into what I could do during my gap year. I knew I wanted to travel, and I decided to go to the island of Bali, which is in Indonesia. I really wanted to volunteer at a national park, but I was too late to apply, so I went for a job at a diving centre. This turned out to be better than other possibilities that I considered, like helping in a school. Although a gap year means taking 12 months out of education, You don't necessarily have to spend the whole time in a different country. I'd give yourself 4 months to save up enough money beforehand, then 6 months abroad, doing whatever it is you've chosen to do, which leaves you 2 months when you return to get ready for university. When it comes to packing, try not to take too much stuff with you. Obviously, you need your travel documents and essentials, like your phone and charger. Then think about any medicine you might need. You'd be surprised at how many people leave that at home. You should also plan how you're going to stay in touch with family and friends. When I first arrived, I wrote a long letter every week to my family about my experiences. I found out they took at least 4 weeks to arrive, though. Then, when I met someone else who had a blog, I realised that that's the thing to do. Of course, an occasional phone call is nice, but in reality, the time difference can make that tricky. There are lots of things you'll need to adapt to when you're in another country. The language, of course, but luckily, so many people speak English. I knew I'd struggle with the spicy food, though most of my friends there loved it. I hadn't realised the effect the climate would have on us, though. I really enjoyed my time away, and I'd definitely recommend taking a gap year. It's a good way to make friends, and you might even develop skills that you can use in the future. You'll gain confidence too, and I think that's the most valuable part of the experience. Now, are there any questions?
That is the end of the talk. In a moment, you will hear exercise 3. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 3. You will hear 6 people talking about relaxation. For each of speakers 1 to 6, choose from the list A to G which opinion each speaker expresses. Write the letter in the appropriate box. Use each letter only once. There is one extra letter which you do not need to use. You will hear the recordings twice. Speaker 1.
These days many people suffer from stress, and so you hear quite a lot about the importance of relaxation. We're surrounded by a variety of books on the subject. Some people even take classes to discover ways to reduce stress levels. I'd say you should always put your responsibilities first, and only then fit in some activities you find relaxing. It's not realistic to expect to do something relaxing on a daily basis. Sometimes you might have to wait until the weekend, or even your next holiday.
Speaker 2.
I recently saw a leaflet about a relaxation course, but do people really need to be taught how to relax? While I agree that relaxation is very important, this seems to be a step too far. All you need to do to forget about the stresses of work is go to the gym or for a nice long run. My friend and I often do this in the woods near my house. If the weather's good, it's lovely spending time surrounded by nature after a busy day at the office.
Speaker 3.
When I was younger, there was nothing I found more relaxing than spending time with my classmates. We'd get together during the holidays, and not having any responsibilities, We'd often watch a film or enjoy some outdoor activities, like a bike ride. We used to hang out together almost every day. A few months after I began my first job, I started to feel like I just needed some time to myself every now and then in order to relax properly. So that's what I do whenever I get the chance.
Speaker 4.
I think that adults find it quite difficult to relax. Take my parents as an example. We've recently been on a nice holiday and they were constantly on their work phones. I try to encourage them to take things easy, but they never pay any attention. I don't think they realise that daily relaxation is more important than work. Me, on the other hand, I always find an hour or so to chill out, whether it's meeting up with friends or simply doing nothing at home.
Speaker 5.
I often wonder how many people manage to relax every day. I mean, it's great to spend an hour or so in your own company or with a friend, and it's something I'm starting to do at least a couple of times a week. I also try to make time to get to the gym at the weekend. Last month, I had a few days off in the countryside. I did practically nothing, and it was amazing how quickly the tension disappeared with each breath of fresh air.
Speaker 6.
After a demanding week, I used to lock myself away with a book for the entire evening. I found it was quite effective in keeping my stress levels down, but I was aware I wasn't being particularly sociable. So, when someone at the gym was offering a weekly session on how to lower stress, I signed up. We looked at a variety of methods, from outdoor activities to yoga and meditation, and I've been trying to introduce them into my life. I'd recommend this to anyone finding it hard to relax.
Now you will hear the six speakers again. Speaker 1.
These days, many people suffer from stress, and so you hear quite a lot about the importance of relaxation. We're surrounded by a variety of books on the subject. Some people even take classes to discover ways to reduce stress levels. I'd say you should always put your responsibilities first and only then fit in some activities you find relaxing. It's not realistic to expect to do something relaxing on a daily basis. Sometimes you might have to wait until the weekend or even your next holiday.
Speaker 2.
I recently saw a leaflet about a relaxation course, but do people really need to be taught how to relax? While I agree that relaxation is very important, this seems to be a step too far. All you need to do to forget about the stresses of work is go to the gym or for a nice long run. My friend and I often do this in the woods near my house. If the weather's good, it's lovely spending time surrounded by nature after a busy day at the office.
Speaker 3.
When I was younger, there was nothing I found more relaxing than spending time with my classmates. We'd get together during the holidays, and not having any responsibilities, we'd often watch a film or enjoy some outdoor activities, like a bike ride. We used to hang out together almost every day. A few months after I began my first job, I started to feel like I just needed some time to myself every now and then in order to relax properly. So that's what I do whenever I get the chance.
Speaker 4.
I think that adults find it quite difficult to relax. Take my parents as an example. We've recently been on a nice holiday and they were constantly on their work phones. I try to encourage them to take things easy, but they never pay any attention. I don't think they realise that daily relaxation is more important than work. Me, on the other hand, I always find an hour or so to chill out, whether it's meeting up with friends or simply doing nothing at home.
Speaker 5.
I often wonder how many people manage to relax every day. I mean, it's great to spend an hour or so in your own company or with a friend, and it's something I'm starting to do at least a couple of times a week. I also try to make time to get to the gym at the weekend. Last month, I had a few days off in the countryside. I did practically nothing, and it was amazing how quickly the tension disappeared with each breath of fresh air.
Speaker 6.
After a demanding week, I used to lock myself away with a book for the entire evening. I found it was quite effective in keeping my stress levels down, but I was aware I wasn't being particularly sociable. So, when someone at the gym was offering a weekly session on how to lower stress, I signed up. We looked at a variety of methods, from outdoor activities to yoga and meditation, and I've been trying to introduce them into my life. I'd recommend this to anyone finding it hard to relax.
That is the end of exercise 3. In a moment, you will hear exercise 4. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 4. You will hear an interview with Gillian Smith, who looks after elephants at a safari park. Listen to the interview and look at the questions. For each question, choose the correct answer, A, B, or C, and put a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the interview twice.
Today, I'm interviewing Gillian Smith, who looks after elephants at a safari park. Gillian, what made you choose this type of work?
When I was young, I actually wanted to be a pilot. I used to dream about flying. But then one summer, my friend and I got a job at the local zoo. My friend quit after a week to take up a waitressing job and tried to talk me into doing the same, but I wanted to stay on. Soon enough, I knew that working with animals was the career for me.
So what was your parents' reaction to your decision?
It must have been difficult for them. Both my parents are school teachers, and even though they love animals, I think they hoped I'd continue in the family tradition. So they weren't entirely happy with my choice, but they never once attempted to persuade me to change my mind. They were actually rather supportive, and I'm very grateful for that.
Tell us what it's like working with wild animals.
Well, they're unpredictable for sure, though we do try to provide some structure as they clearly benefit from that. Typically, a proportion of my day is spent in contact with the animals so that we can form a bond, though that takes time. We also organise challenges and activities to keep them occupied physically and mentally. But it's equally important for the animals to be left alone as they would be in the wild.
Is there anything particular happening at the safari park at the moment?
We're currently caring for 7 African elephants. Last year, we were really pleased to welcome a young elephant, Matilda, to the park. Luckily, she settled in really quickly. Her arrival enabled me to identify several factors that make the settling in process easier. I'm now using this experience to help with a long-term study I'm involved in. I also train new staff and teach them all about our resident elephants, which I really enjoy, but there's nobody new right now.
So, has working with elephants changed you as a person?
To some degree, yes. You never really know how an animal is going to react in certain situations, so there are often issues to deal with. That's something I've always been good at, though I've realised I find it much easier when I'm working on my own rather than with other members of staff. What's become clearer to me over time is that when you have a group of animals that depend on you for their well-being, you just can't let them down.
Are there any negative aspects to your job?
I'm afraid so. People think that if you work with animals, it's mostly fun, and they forget that at times it's exhausting work. I don't actually mind that. But when we return an animal that's been in the park for some time to its natural habitat, I can't help feeling sad. For me, that's even more upsetting than when they become unwell.
And what about the best part?
It's lovely to see animals being born in the park, especially if there are very few of them left in the wild. I know my colleagues find it extremely satisfying, but what I find more rewarding is talking to families and school groups who come to the park about the species in our care and explaining how we help them. What I do is never going to make the headlines, but I'm not bothered about that.
Do you have any tips for people interested in a job like yours?
I'd say I've got the greatest job in the world. If you want to give it a go, see if you can secure some part-time or volunteer work first. Having a relevant degree helps, but isn't necessary to start with. Go to some safari parks if you can, but remember that as a visitor, you're only seeing a small part of what the job is all about.
Gillian, it's been great talking to you.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Today, I'm interviewing Gillian Smith, who looks after elephants at a safari park. Gillian, what made you choose this type of work?
When I was young, I actually wanted to be a pilot. I used to dream about flying. But then one summer, my friend and I got a job at the local zoo. My friend quit after a week to take up a waitressing job and tried to talk me into doing the same. But I wanted to stay on. Soon enough, I knew that working with animals was the career for me.
So what was your parents' reaction to your decision?
It must have been difficult for them. Both my parents are school teachers, and even though they love animals, I think they hoped I'd continue in the family tradition. So they weren't entirely happy with my choice, but they never once attempted to persuade me to change my mind. They were actually rather supportive, and I'm very grateful for that.
Tell us what it's like working with wild animals.
Well, they're unpredictable for sure, though we do try to provide some structure as they clearly benefit from that. Typically, a proportion of my day is spent in contact with the animals so that we can form a bond, though that takes time. We also organise challenges and activities to keep them occupied physically and mentally. But it's equally important for the animals to be left alone as they would be in the wild.
Is there anything particular happening at the safari park at the moment?
We're currently caring for 7 African elephants. Last year we were really pleased to welcome a young elephant, Matilda, to the park. Luckily, she settled in really quickly. Her arrival enabled me to identify several factors that make the settling in process easier. I'm now using this experience to help with a long-term study I'm involved in. I also train new staff and teach them all about our resident elephants, which I really enjoy, but there's nobody new right now.
So, has working with elephants changed you as a person?
To some degree, yes. You never really know how an animal is going to react in certain situations, so there are often issues to deal with. That's something I've always been good at, though I've realised I find it much easier when I'm working on my own rather than with other members of staff. What's become clearer to me over time is that when you have a group of animals that depend on you for their well-being, you just can't let them down.
Are there any negative aspects to your job?
I'm afraid so. People think that if you work with animals, it's mostly fun, and they forget that at times it's exhausting work. I don't actually mind that. But when we return an animal that's been in the park for some time to its natural habitat, I can't help feeling sad. For me, that's even more upsetting than when they become unwell.
And what about the best part?
It's lovely to see animals being born in the park, especially if there are very few of them left in the wild. I know my colleagues find it extremely satisfying, but what I find more rewarding is talking to families and school groups who come to the park about the species in our care and explaining how we help them. What I do is never going to make the headlines, but I'm not bothered about that.
Do you have any tips for people interested in a job like yours?
I'd say I've got the greatest job in the world. If you want to give it a go, see if you can secure some part-time or volunteer work first. Having a relevant degree helps, but isn't necessary to start with. Go to some safari parks if you can, but remember that as a visitor, you're only seeing a small part of what the job is all about.
Gillian, it's been great talking to you.
That is the end of the interview. In a moment, you will hear exercise 5. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 5, Part A. You will hear a teacher giving a talk about mass tourism and its impact on the Italian city of Venice. Listen to the talk and complete the sentences in Part A. Write one or two words or a number in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
Today, I'd like to talk about a place that's been negatively affected by mass tourism, the Italian city of Venice. As you know, mass tourism involves huge numbers of people visiting the same destination, often during a particular time of year. Venice has been a popular tourist destination for many centuries. Whilst many people think mass tourism only goes back to the late 20th century, Venice was visited by many wealthy northern Europeans as far back as the 17th century. However, in recent years, particularly since the very early 21st century, this wonderful destination has struggled to cope with mass tourism. The fact is that we live in an era of bargain travel. Cheap flights are readily available. However, the greatest impact comes from cruise ships. The result is that at any one time, there are more visitors than residents in Venice. Visitors are driving up property prices, as many houses get bought up and used for tourist accommodation, forcing local residents to relocate to the mainland. The result of this process is that the city is turning into something like a museum, and Venice is now a tourist city without a low season. How does Venice deal with the approximately 20 million tourists that visit every year? Many are day trippers, which means they don't spend enough money in the city. That's why the mayor of Venice has considered increasing the entrance fees to some tourist sites, as well as introducing an entrance fee to the city itself. A further proposal is to charge an overnight stay tax. At present, there is considerable overcrowding at the most popular tourist sites. Adding more water buses to make it easier for tourists to go to other interesting sites in the city is a simple and effective answer to the problem, as far as I'm concerned. The residents of Venice believe that the solution lies in promoting what's known as responsible tourism. An organization has recently been set up to support local business people by promoting their shops so that money spent in Venice stays in Venice. Their website lists the shops which sell souvenirs created by residents, rather than the ones imported from large factories abroad. So, if tourists fancy spending their money on something other than a nice coffee or a slice of pizza, but want to do it responsibly, they should check out which shops to visit.
Now you will hear the talk again.
Today, I'd like to talk about a place that's been negatively affected by mass tourism, the Italian city of Venice. As you know, mass tourism involves huge numbers of people visiting the same destination, often during a particular time of year. Venice has been a popular tourist destination for many centuries. Whilst many people think mass tourism only goes back to the late 20th century, Venice was visited by many wealthy northern Europeans as far back as the 17th century. However, in recent years, particularly since the very early 21st century, this wonderful destination has struggled to cope with mass tourism. The fact is that we live in an era of bargain travel. Cheap flights are readily available. However, the greatest impact comes from cruise ships. The result is that at any one time, there are more visitors than residents in Venice. Visitors are driving up property prices, as many houses get bought up and used for tourist accommodation, forcing local residents to relocate to the mainland. The result of this process is that the city is turning into something like a museum, and Venice is now a tourist city without a low season. How does Venice deal with the approximately 20 million tourists that visit every year? Many are day trippers, which means they don't spend enough money in the city. That's why the mayor of Venice has considered increasing the entrance fees to some tourist sites, as well as introducing an entrance fee to the city itself. A further proposal is to charge an overnight stay tax. At present, there is considerable overcrowding at the most popular tourist sites. Adding more water buses to make it easier for tourists to go to other interesting sites in the city is a simple and effective answer to the problem, as far as I'm concerned. The residents of Venice believe that the solution lies in promoting what's known as responsible tourism. An organization has recently been set up to support local business people by promoting their shops so that money spent in Venice stays in Venice. Their website lists the shops which sell souvenirs created by residents, rather than the ones imported from large factories abroad. So, if tourists fancy spending their money on something other than a nice coffee or a slice of pizza, but want to do it responsibly, they should check out which shops to visit.
Part B. Now listen to a conversation between two students about the girls' plans to visit Venice and complete the sentences in Part B. Write one or two words only in each gap. You will hear the conversation twice.
Hi, Mia. That lecture about mass tourism in Venice really makes you think, doesn't it?
I know. I hope things will take a turn for the better soon, as it's such an amazing place. In fact, I'm planning a trip there soon.
Sounds good. When are you going?
Well, the plane tickets are quite good value in July, and I think the weather is slightly less hot then than later in the summer. But I really want to go to the Venice International Film Festival, which is scheduled for the last 2 weeks of August. October would be the most affordable option, if we weren't back at university then.
So, have you done your research on how to be a good tourist? For example, did you know that local residents get really irritated when people walk on the wrong side of the street or sit on the steps of a bridge?
No, I didn't actually.
But apparently, the worst offence is when they take photos in the middle of a bridge. Even worse than accidentally poking somebody with a selfie stick. In fact, I heard that they've already banned selfie sticks.
I think that's another city you're thinking about, where they haven't only banned selfie sticks, but also bottles and firecrackers. Anyway, I heard that the city council in Venice introduced a law banning bicycles from the centre.
That's the first I've heard about that. But I do know that you're supposed to dress appropriately when you visit churches, of course. No shorts allowed.
That's fair enough.
So anyway, where are you going to stay?
Well, one option is a chain hotel. Quite a few of them are owned by foreign companies, and I'd prefer to support local businesses instead, especially after that talk. I also thought about booking a privately owned apartment, though it just doesn't feel right to stay in somebody else's home now that we understand the issues local residents face. Right now, I can't think of a better bet than a hostel. They're such good value.
Why don't you look at an online travel forum? You can get some great advice. I used one once for finding out about places to eat.
I tend to rely on local recommendations for restaurants. I'll definitely look at one, though. It'll come in handy for getting information on exhibitions, don't you think?
Yeah. Anyway, I hope you enjoy it whenever you go.
Thanks, Jonas.
Now you will hear the conversation again.
Hi, Mia. That lecture about mass tourism in Venice really makes you think, doesn't it?
I know. I hope things will take a turn for the better soon, as it's such an amazing place. In fact, I'm planning a trip there soon.
Sounds good. When are you going?
Well, the plane tickets are quite good value in July, and I think the weather is slightly less hot then than later in the summer. But I really want to go to the Venice International Film Festival, which is scheduled for the last 2 weeks of August. October would be the most affordable option, if we weren't back at university then.
So, have you done your research on how to be a good tourist? For example, did you know that local residents get really irritated when people walk on the wrong side of the street or sit on the steps of a bridge?
No, I didn't actually.
But apparently, the worst offence is when they take photos in the middle of a bridge. Even worse than accidentally poking somebody with a selfie stick. In fact, I heard that they've already banned selfie sticks.
I think that's another city you're thinking about, where they haven't only banned selfie sticks, but also bottles and firecrackers. Anyway, I heard that the city council in Venice introduced a law banning bicycles from the centre.
That's the first I've heard about that. But I do know that you're supposed to dress appropriately when you visit churches, of course. No shorts allowed.
That's fair enough.
So anyway, where are you going to stay?
Well, one option is a chain hotel. Quite a few of them are owned by foreign companies. And I'd prefer to support local businesses instead, especially after that talk. I also thought about booking a privately owned apartment. Though it just doesn't feel right to stay in somebody else's home now that we understand the issues local residents face. Right now, I can't think of a better bet than a hostel. They're such good value.
Why don't you look at an online travel forum? You can get some great advice. I used one once for finding out about places to eat.
I tend to rely on local recommendations for restaurants. I'll definitely look at one, though. It'll come in handy for getting information on exhibitions, don't you think?
Yeah. Anyway, I hope you enjoy it whenever you go.
Thanks, Jonas.
That is the end of Exercise 5 and of the exam. In a moment, your teacher will collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, centre number and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, please collect all the papers.